Hi everyone, this is Katia, executive producer of OTM. So as you can imagine, lots of feelings being felt here in the office Wednesday morning. Feelings we didn't quite know what to do with. Also pressing what to put down the feed this week for our podcast extra. I thought if I were an OTM listener, what would I want to hear? I would want to hear Bob and Brooke talking through how they are feeling today and how they envisioned the direction of the show during the Trump presidency. So we went into the studio to hash that out, and here it is.
So anyway, what happened last night made me think about what we've been doing the last couple of years, especially the last year, and what we ought to consider doing in the future. I don't think our role is to be Cassandra-in-chief or even consoler-in-chief. I think that our main role is to make what seems to have been invisible to us and everyone we know, visible. We have to do an even better job of reporting and pull back, not entirely, of course, but to some degree from commentary. I'm not saying we extirpate it. It's part of our brand. We've always been transparent, and I want to continue that. I think we need to be more fair. And that means we have to talk to people that we have discounted.
Do you think that we were unfair?
With regard to the election, I think that we fell into the trap of everyone else. The focus was never on his supporters until the very end.
It's clear to me that while we imagined ourselves speaking truth to power, and I suppose we did, we were also very much stuck within the echo chamber. And to the extent that our message was getting out beyond the liberal, progressive, non-Trump supporting community, it was probably dismissed as simply liberal boilerplate. I don't necessarily regret doing that because I think we repeatedly had to make a judgment whether the historic threat to our democracy and to our values was reason enough to veer away from kind of in-depth reporting on what made the electorate what it is. And that may be true. But actually, I think the bigger story that the press missed overall has been the quintessential slow-boiling frog situation. And that is that there's been a 30-some year campaign of big lies, of demagogues in politics and in conservative media telling this ever-growing, more frustrated, more marginalized audience a number of things that are, you know, objectively untrue. I think that happened and kind of softened the target for an opportunist demagogue like Donald Trump. 50% of the electorate believes that we are under siege from all sides and our economy and our society is being destroyed, when objectively speaking, none of that's true. Wealth inequality is a big problem, but the economy is growing. It's chugging along slowly, but it's growing. The unemployment is low historically, taxation is historically low, but it doesn't matter because the people who voted for Trump believe the collapse was underway. So I think that where the media failed was by letting the frog boil slowly to the point that the public in a gigantic way was misinformed. So what does that tell us about how to approach fairness? Are you being fair or unfair to your audience by reflexively throwing bones at ideas that you don't think have merit?
What you describe is in no way how I describe fairness. The way that I intend it is simply to put more voices on the air, not to give them a free ride, not to shy away from disputing every assertion they might make that the facts disagree with, simply to make them present.
And make us better informed.
About who they are.
Yeah.
But I don't think these explanations are mutually exclusive.
Well, I do, because if we focus on the 30-year lie, we're having an argument about stuff that happened during the Nixon administrations and not stuff that we've ignored. You've brought it up a lot this year. It has undergirded many of our discussions, but I think that it will drag us into a very established narrative when we really have to find out what's going on now.
Can we go mega transparent, Brooke?
Yeah.
Let's go mega transparent.
Sure, go ahead.
For the 16-year history of this show, we have had conversations in our editorial meetings that the audience is not privy to about stories in which we're fighting for truth, justice in the American way, and we're trying to decide how to report them or whether to report them. And there is a term of art.
And we haven't used it in years.
Yeah. The term is it too democracy now? Are we turning from being journalists whose beat is the media into activists flogging a set of political ideals, all right?
The reason why I stopped using the term is because Democracy Now! Has consistently broken news, and basically they hearken back to the old era of, you know, advocacy journalism.
Okay, so let's to explain that Democracy Now! Is a long-standing radio show that its history is in public radio, not NPR, but public radio, and it is now broadcast on TV. And the question that I think that we face is, do we continue to go more in the direction that it takes, understanding that our core audience expects something from us, that if we continue on the Democracy Now! Path, we can certainly deliver, amp up the skepticism and outrage, or we can pull back and be, say, more dispassionate observers of the media scene and the political scene. I'm not sure if we can do both of those things.
So the Democracy Now! Path, as you define it, it's not a definition I share, but just so I understand what you mean.
Well, it's a progressive bastion, right? It is a explicitly liberal progressive bastion.
So this is where you feel we have gone during the Trump campaign. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and thanks in large part to, you know, my insistence that we cover Trump not as a politician, but as a historic threat, a potential menace to democracy. So, yeah, I mean, I've been pounding that message as often as I can, and that crosses the line between journalism that we expect into a kind of activism. I don't think I ever mentioned Hillary Clinton's name during the whole course of the campaign, but I, and by extension the show, became an activist player in anti-Trumpism. So now what do we do?
This brings me back to the beginning. What I feel we need to do is to start making what was invisible to us visible. That means to bring in voices to argue with honestly, face-to-face. Like when I brought in, you know, the former cop gun enthusiast and had an honest conversation about what I just don't get. And to give the opportunity for people to explain what it is we don't get and argue about the facts that underpin these opinions and do all of that in an absolutely straightforward way. I just want to hear from those people.
Remember during the Bush administration, we had to find a framing device. We were unnerved. We didn't know what was going to happen, but that was politics. We're like, well, that's not our beat. And so then we came up with enabling condition, which
was enabling condition, free speech and privacy, all those things that enable the freedom of information and that enable journalism that were not, strictly speaking, media.
Yeah. So we came up with the media frame. And then when Obama won in 08, we were like, what's our new frame? What's our discussion? What's it going to be? Really quickly turned to transparency, surveillance. What is our frame? What's it going to be? I feel like we don't know. It's going to include talking to people.
We sort of cease to be a media show at all.
Well,
right?
No. What I'm saying is,
we become just an at-large observer of American life.
No, I think that we will find our frame for what this discussion is. We'll find the way to see us through our, you know, ever more vague media filter that we apply to things. But I think that we will find a frame. I don't doubt it.
Well, I suspect that our media role, our function, will have to do with narratives and framing, constantly identifying and anatomizing those narratives of our colleagues in the mainstream media and also those outside of it. And maybe the word mainstream no longer exists. Fox, we remember Megyn Kelly said that Fox is not mainstream. I don't think so. When what she really meant was not liberal. So maybe we don't have a mainstream media anymore. Another thing is, I think if we are going to advocate, it's going to be for people to pay for their information, because a lot of this could be attributed to the intense shrinkage of actual reporting firepower because there isn't any money for it.
That could be a definite bumper sticker for us. One thing I think is going to be interesting is that we rely on historical context to deflate panic, right? To diffuse panic. We're going to talk to James Fallows this week about all of the precedent-setting events in the last 15 months. Where's our historical precedent that makes us feel better? Where are the historical parallels where we go, I don't know. I don't
complain to me about Godwin's law anymore.
Why?
No, that's
we
not.
Don't have Hitler, and the Republic survived the Civil War.
Yes, that's true. But what happens if President Donald Trump does half the things he's promised to do?
Right.
Then what do we do?
If you're going to bring out the, you know, the rhetorical heavy artillery, you do it in response to actual real things, not to his own rhetorical flourishes. We don't hate Hitler because he made ugly speeches.
But I haven't compared him to Hitler. What I have said is that the political process is looking exactly like Weimar Germany, which was a nation that made a historically bad decision, catastrophic decision, based on exactly the same kind of fears and hatreds that have propelled Donald Trump into office. Now, whether that demagoguery turns into something deeply dark, I don't know. But, you know, I refuse to be put off the idea that the political forces aren't a direct parallel to what got Hitler elected before he did a single ugly act.
And you have made that observation, I think, probably half a dozen times on the show, but we are past the phase of the election.
I think that people will be listening to this discussion, our listeners, and they'll say, Bob and Brooke, tell me how to feel. What should I do today?
Well, Bob, you want to go first?
Well, speaking personally, I'm afraid and I'm ashamed. And I'm angry. And as to what to do next, I don't know. But, I think Brooke and I, even though we've had this marriage encounter session, we fundamentally agree that on the media's role is to keep our finger on the pulse of the nation and the media's coverage of the events as dispassionately as we can without surrendering our commitment to truth and sanity and the Constitution and all that goes with it. And the one last thought I would offer on that subject is I think our core audience is looking for us to do more of what we did during the election. I've seen a lot of tweets, you know, we need you more than ever, and that sort of thing. And, you know, the question is, do we try to approach our jobs as leaders of a movement for truth and justice, or do we just try to do our jobs as journalists covering journalism and let the rest sort itself out? I'm not sure we can do exactly both at the same time.
I guess I would say I think we can do exactly both at the same time. And the reason is that just shining a light gives people the information to pursue their goals. And I guess if I were talking to the listener's cat, which I am, I guess, hi there, what I would say is simply, you know, you have a couple of choices. You can sit back and give way to panic and embrace all the terrible analogies, or we can simply keep our eyes open day by day and stay engaged. I mean, if you hate the outcome of this election, there is another one in 2 years that could change the Congress.
As the president says, democracy is messy, and that's what elections are for.
And we also know that people during midterm elections and during primaries tend to be the most committed. So are you committed? Are you in? Or are you out? This is about the American experiment and whether it fails. I mean, Krugman called America a failed state. That doesn't have to be. That doesn't have to be. The country is evenly divided. That means half of the nation agrees with you. So get everybody off their asses.
I hope that it's some sort of clarion call. But what I most hope, Brooke and Kat and producers and audience, is that we are not all passengers on the ship of fools.
What the fuck?
I don't know
does
what that
mean
either. What does that mean?
What does it mean?
Why would you want to end on the line of we're all going to hell?
Perhaps I misunderstood, but if you wanted to know what I'm thinking and feeling and what we should do, I have just told you.
All right.
Now, you can think it's ridiculous and hyperbolic, but you thought my warnings about Trump were ridiculous and hyperbolic.
I did not.
Yeah, we didn't.
At some point, we have to reckon with what just happened last night.
Well, don't mischaracterize me and what was in my mind. If I had felt that way, they wouldn't have been on the program.
Well, I rest my case at Ship of Fools.
Okay.
And that wraps up the morning after.
Okay.
All right. On the show this week, we will examine the idea that rather than missing the story, we and everybody else just deluded ourselves into not seeing the story. We'll see you then.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.